Kapitula and also ask you to forgive me, as well as being firstly unqualified, I also haven't had much time to prepare, so please bless me that I might say something hopefully nice, but anything at all would also be good. So we're reading from the 6th canto, chapter 9, text 34, and this chapter is entitled The Appearance of the Demon Vritrasura, and it's a prose verse, so I'll just read it.
Dura Prabodha Ivata Vayam Vihara Yoga Ashana Shariyaridam Anavakshita Smat Samavaya Atmanaiva Vikriyamanena Sagunam Aguna Shinchasi Pasi Harashi. Dura Prabodham, difficult to understand. Iva, quite. Tava, yo. I am this. Vihara Yoga, engagements in the pastimes of creation, maintenance, and annihilation. Yat, which. Asharanam, not dependent on any other support. Asharira, without having a material body. Idam, this. Anavekshita, without waiting for. Asmat, of us. Samavaya, the cooperation. Atmana, by your own self. Eva, indeed. Avikriya, Manena, without being transformed. Sagunam, the material modes of nature. Aguna, although transcendental to such material qualities. Shinjasi, you create. Pasi, maintain. Harashi, annihilate. Translation. O Lord, you need no support, and although you have no material body, you do not need cooperation from us. Since you are the cause of all the cosmic manifestation, and you supply its material ingredients without being transformed, you create, maintain, and annihilate this cosmic manifestation by yourself. Nevertheless, although you appear engaged in material activity, you are transcendental to all material qualities. Consequently, these transcendental activities of yours are extremely difficult to understand. By his divine grace, Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada ki! The Brahma Samhita 5.37 says, Goloka eva nivasacha akhila mabhuta. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, is always situated in Goloka Vrindavan. It also says, Vrindavanam pariyaja padam ekam nagachati. Krishna never goes even a step from Vrindavan. Nevertheless, although Krishna is situated in his own abode, Goloka Vrindavan, he is simultaneously all-pervading and is therefore present everywhere. This is very difficult for a conditioned soul to understand, but the devotees can understand how Krishna, without undergoing any changes, can simultaneously be in his abode and be all-pervasive. The demigods are understood to be various limbs of the Supreme Lord's body, although the Supreme Lord has no material body and does not need anyone's help. He is spread everywhere, maya tatam ivam savam jagat ava avyakta murtina. Nevertheless, he is not present everywhere in his spiritual form. According to the Mayavada philosophy, the Supreme Truth, being all-pervasive, does not need a transcendental form. The Mayavadis suppose that since his form is distributed everywhere, he has no form. This is untrue. The Lord keeps his transcendental form, and at the same time, he extends everywhere, in every nook and corner of the material creation. Shrimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Niti Namine Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Vicharine Nivishesha Shunyavadi Vastrachala Shatayane. So when these prayers of the demigods were initially starting, they were in the form of poetry, but
we see as they progress along. They have taken the form of prose. And in the fifth canto, we hear that the Brahmin, that the Yajna of Kumavi, who wanted to have a son just like the Supreme Lord, they're also offering prayers in prose instead of in poetic form. So this is mentioned as significant. And when we read these prayers, we can see they're filled with a lot of remorse. The priests of the sacrifice are very regretful that they should be asking the Lord, who has appeared in the sacrificial arena, for something material, where he's able to grant anything, but they should be asking for something which is essentially so temporary. So we can sort of feel the same mood of remorse in these prayers. But the demigods, they are dependent on the Lord, so they have no other shelter. But we hear that a devotee, although he has this dependency upon the Lord, he doesn't like to ask the Lord for anything. Therefore, there is this sense of they're ashamed to be asking the Lord for his assistance, but also essentially they're praying for protection from the demon Vritrasura, but he has been created because of Vishwaroop's murder by Indra. So in a sense they are sort of responsible for their own suffering. I mean, the demons are always attacking the demigods, there's eternal battles between them. And in this sense they can be feeling slightly ashamed. Also, they're also feeling very distressed because Trisor is this enormous demon that we see in the wonderful illustration at the beginning. We have this beautiful picture. Here's Indra on the back of Airavata. Here is Vritrasura. And I remember when I first listened to these pastimes on audio, and I think, wow, Vritrasura must be very big, like maybe twice the size of Indra, but just look at him, he's a giant, he's more than a giant, he's like a mountain in the face of Indra. So the subject matter of this verse is, by its own admission, very difficult to comprehend. So I thought I might speak a little about the context of this verse and the pastime of Indra fighting Vritrasura. So in the Western world, we have many stories of good against evil. We hear this theme over and over again. Fable and fiction, it's part of our culture that evil will triumph and defeat good, but good will rise again. So the simple version of the story would be that Trasta creates this demon who he wants to kill Indra, and Indra and the demon fight, and Indra defeats the demon, and they all go home and drink some morass and live happily ever after until the next time. And this is pretty much how the story of Indra and Vritra is told in the Vedas. It's also present in the Rig Veda in glorifying Indra. They talk about how he defeats Vritrasura.
and so Indra's really great, so let's all offer him sacrifices. That's kind of removed of the Vedas. But now we see here, Vritra is this great saintly devotee. I mean, I'll just read some extracts from his prayers. Oh my Lord, O Supreme Personality of Godhead, will I again be able to be the servant of your eternal servants who find shelter only at your lotus feet? O Lord of my life, may I again become their servant so that my mind may always think of your transcendental attributes. My words always glorify those attributes and my body always engages in the loving service. Your Lordship. O lotus-eyed Lord, as baby birds that have not yet developed their wings always look for their mothers to return and feed them, as small calves tied with ropes await anxiously the time of milking when they will be allowed to drink the milk of their mothers, or as a morose wife whose husband is away from home always longs for him to return and satisfy her in all respects, I always yearn for the opportunity to render direct service unto you. So imagine if we were simply having an argument with such a person and they came out with these wonderful prayers. You immediately want to forgive them, but Indra, he has to kill this saintly soul. And so in this seemingly the battle between demigod and demon, we almost ask ourselves, well, who is the demon here? Who is the demigod? But actually, we see that they're both devotees. And this is sort of, it's very kind of, ambiguous fight between Indra and Vritra, because we know that Indra is going to win. He has this thunderbolt from the bones of the sage Adichie. He's empowered to defeat Vritrasura. But as we read these passages, we don't really know who it is we're rooting for. We can't help thinking that Vritra is the innocent party. And as Indra hears all these prayers, Indra doesn't want to have to kill Vritra. He doesn't want to kill this devotee. But Vritra, he wants to be killed. This is his last stage of purification before going home back to Godhead. So he's acting out of duty, but ultimately, let's see, purified. So we have this sort of intense but reluctant fight, and with Vritra fighting as hard as he can, and Indra not really wanting to do this final deed. And we hear that even with one arm, Vritrasura is able to disarm Indra, and he knocks the thunderbolt from his hand, and Indra is ashamed. He's like, okay, I'm defeated. And Vritra's like, what are you doing? He's like, well, you've knocked the thunderbolt from my hand. You defeated me. Just finish me. And Vritra's like, no, pick it up. Like, this is your service. Like, pick it up. Try again. So we hear many descriptions of when Krishna fights with the demons, but it's very clear who's going to end up victorious. Even when he's enjoying this rasa of fighting, and example, Varaha and Hiranyaksha, they engage in very fierce fighting, clubs smashing against each other. But in the end, all that Varaha has to do is, and he slaps him at the base of the ear, and he collapses, he falls down dead. And when the Lord fights, it's very glorious, and
when the demon is defeated, the flowers rain down from the heavens and celestial drums are beating and all the Apsaras are dancing in joy. But when this battle is over, no one talks to Indra. He's defeated Vritra, but they didn't speak to him. And it's because they're all very happy that this demon has been killed, because he was such a threat to them, he was such a burden. But they can also tell that Indra was very distraught to actually have to do this deed. So it's almost as if when someone is in great suffering, we don't know what to say to them. And that anything we can think to say seems so insignificant. So we have so many chivalrous pastimes within the Bhagavatam between the Lord and demons, but it's always for the sense of pleasure, like when Krishna initiates this fight with Jambavan over the Shamantakaju. It's Jambavan thinks he's dealing with an aggressor, and it's like he's entering his home and trying to take this jewel, but Krishna, he's enjoying the fight, he wants to fight, and he's like, yes, let me enjoy this fight with my devotee. I mean, Krishna is the greatest hero. He couldn't be God if he wasn't heroic. But he's also having fun. This is Krishna's nature to enjoy. We see this as a fight out of duty, and duty can sometimes be very painful. It has lots of parallels, actually, with the Bhagavad Gita. Because Krishna is encouraging Arjuna to fight and do this duty for his pleasure. And similarly, Vritrasuri is encouraging Indra and saying, like, this fight has been ordained by Lord Vishnu, so this is your service, this is your duty. And even then, they actually, midway through the fight, they actually stop and have a discussion on devotional service, because they're both devotees. And then they resume this fighting as a matter of duty. So you find that many people, there are many examples, especially in warfare, in the Bhagavatam, where this sense of honouring your duty seems contradictory to serving the Lord. Just Bhishma describes in his prayers in the first canto that he's actually shooting arrows on the body of the Lord, and there are great wounds involved, and his form is smeared with blood and dust from the battlefield. But it's described that although these arrows were striking the body of the Lord, because they were the offering of his devotee, Krishna felt them to be just like a shower of roses upon him. And actually, the Lord's body is not material, it cannot be cut or pierced like our body can, but he manifests these wounds to enjoy the chivalrous pastime. So here we have Indra and Vritra faced against each other. Two devotees with this superficial opposition to each other.
They're on either side of the battlefield, but their ultimate goal is the same. They want to serve the Lord. And at the same time, although they're forced to fight each other, can see there's this great respect between them. Even Indra offers prayers to Vritrasura, and he said, like, demons are generally in the mode of passion, but I can see you're so saintly and you have no leanings towards this material world. And Indra is thinking, because you're such a saintly devotee, like, how am I supposed to kill you? And Vritra is thinking, because Indra is the servant of Vishnu, and this as well, you must kill me, I must be killed. And so they're forced to act in these different capacities. And therefore this is very powerful. We're not used to seeing this, that this fight should be so unbiased. So to relate Vritrasura's seemingly contradictory nature, and to finish off, I thought I might read some of the prayers from the end of the 11th chapter. So, Sri Vritrasura said, "He who has killed a Brahmana, he who has killed his spiritual master, indeed, he who has killed my brother, is now, by good fortune, standing before me, face to face as my enemy. O most abominable one, when I pierce your stone-like heart with my trident, I shall be free from the debt to my brother. Only for the sake of living in the heavenly planets, you killed my elder brother, a self-realized, sinless, qualified Brahmana, who had been appointed your chief priest. He was your spiritual master, but although you entrusted him with the performance of your sacrifice, you later mercilessly severed his head from his body, the way one butchers an animal. Indra, you are bereft of all shame, mercy, glory, and good fortune. Deprived of all these good qualities by the reactions of your fruitive activities, you are to be condemned even by the man-eaters. Now I shall pierce your body with my trident, and after you die with great pain, even fire will not touch you. Only the vultures will eat your body. You are naturally cruel. If the other demigods, unaware of my prowess, follow you by attacking me with raised weapons, I shall sever their heads with this sharp trident. Of those heads, I shall perform a sacrifice to Bhairava and other leaders of the ghosts, along with their horns." So at this point, you think, yes. Now, we've seen this kind of demon before. He's mad, bad, and dangerous to know. So, and at this point, we make changes. But if in this battle, you cut off my head with your thunderbolts and kill my soldiers, O Indra, O great hero, I shall take great pleasure in offering my body to other living entities, such as jackals and vultures. I shall thus be relieved of my obligations to the reactions of my karma, and my fortune will be to receive the dust from your lotus feet, dust from the lotus feet of great devotees like Narada Muni. O king of the demigods, since I, your enemy, am standing before you, why don't you hurl your thunderbolts at me? Although your attack upon me with your club was certainly useless, like the request of money from a miser, the thunderbolt you carry will not be useless. You need have no doubts about this. O Indra, king of heaven, the form the bolt you carried to kill me has been empowered by the prowess of Lord Vishnu and the strength of the Dichi's austerities. Since you have come here to kill me in accordance with Lord Vishnu's orders, there is no doubt that I shall be killed by the release of your thunderbolt. Lord Vishnu has sided with you, therefore your victory, opulence, and all good qualities are assured. By the force of your thunderbolt, I shall be free of material bondage, and I shall give up this body and this world's material desires. Fixing my mind upon the lotus feet of Lord Venkatesvara, fixing my mind upon the lotus feet of Lord Sankarshan, I shall attain the destination of such great sages as Narada Muni, just as Lord Sankarshan has said. Persons who fully surrender at the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and always think of his lotus feet, are accepted and recognized by the Lord as his own personal assistants or servants. The Lord never bestows upon such servants the brilliant opulences of the upper, lower, and middle planetary systems of this material world. When one possesses material opulence in any of these three divisions of the universe, his possessions naturally increase his enmity, anxiety, mental agitation, pride, and belligerence. Thus one goes through much endeavor to increase and maintain his possessions, and he suffers great unhappiness when he loses them. Our Lord, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, forbids his devotee to endeavor uselessly for religion, economic development, and sense gratification. O Indra, one can thus infer how kind the Lord is. Such mercy is obtainable only by unalloyed devotees, not by persons who aspire for material gains. O my Lord, O Supreme Personality of Godhead, when will I again be able to be a servant of your eternal servants who find shelter only at your lotus feet? O Lord of my life, may I again become their servant so that my mind may always think of your transcendental attributes, my words always glorify those attributes, and my body always engage in the loving service of your Lordship. O my Lord, source of all opportunities, I do not desire to enjoy in Dhruvaloka, the heavenly planets, or the planet where Lord Brahma resides, nor do I want to be the supreme ruler of all the earthly planets or the lower planetary system. I do not desire to be master of the powers of mystic yoga, nor do I want liberation if I have to give up your lotus feet. O lotus-eyed Lord, as baby birds that have not yet developed their wings always look for their mother to return and feed them, a small calf tied with ropes await anxiously the time of milking, when they will be allowed to drink the milk of their mothers, or as a morose wife whose husband is away from home always longs for him to return and satisfy her in all respects, I always yearn for the opportunity to render devotional service to you. O my Lord, my Master, I am wandering throughout this material world as a result of my fruitive activities. Therefore, I simply seek friendship and the association of your pious and enlightened devotees. My attachment to my body, wife, children, and home is continuing by the spell of your external energy, but I wish to be attached to them no longer. Let my mind, my consciousness, and everything I have to be attached only to you. Kyantara Srimad Bhagavatam Ki. Are there any questions or comments?
I have a question. I read the verse this morning. And in the end of the verse, it explained, you are always prasanta. Speaking to Lord Krishna, you are always prasanta. Therefore, we cannot ever understand your activities. So I was wondering out what does it mean actually, because we read the
give a better answer. Well, Christian activities are very unique, and I remember when I was first reading the Krishna book, I was going through all the pastimes thinking, Krishna's killing a lot of people. He's really getting through demons together. That seems strange. Is he really so enthusiastic about these acts? And when we perform activities to a greater or lesser degree, we are under the influence of material nature. We have minute freedom, but we don't have full independence because we're always being influenced by these material qualities. So my understanding is we cannot fully understand Krishna's activities, firstly because they are fully spiritual in nature, but secondly because Krishna can act in a way that none of us can, because he is the Supreme Lord, and when Krishna comes to this world, although he looks like a human being or a human child, he's not on that platform. He's interacting with the residents of Vrindavan just like their son, friend, or lover, but he is always in his supreme position. So, although we can hear about these activities, we almost cannot understand Krishna's motivations, because he has the supreme position and yet he likes to enjoy in this way. So yes, that was a terrible answer, and I apologize, but yes, I'm sure that someone else would give me a much better answer, so I apologize for that.
In relation to this, I one time heard a lecture, and I don't know for certain who it was, I think it might be Madhavan Swami, and he said that the problem is that when we think of Krishna, we see him as we see ourselves, but then very great. And he's way beyond that. So the way we judge anything Krishna does, we judge it by our limited experience, but then we see him, okay, he's a very, very great personality.
Mm-hmm.
But we can't think beyond that.
Yes, and we hear many people trying to imitate the rasa dance and think, oh, Krishna has so many girlfriends, let me do this too. But actually, all the souls are Krishna's servants, so actually, this is only a minute portion of his devotees. So actually, although this rasa dance looks very extravagant in the moral sense, but the morality on the position of God is very modest, really. Just a couple of the... Yes, sorry, I'm getting distracted.
I think I read this recently from Prabhupada saying, how can the limited understand the unlimited? Is that not possible? Because he's all the time expanding and becoming bigger and bigger, and things are happening. So, like, even not even Ananta Shesha is able to catch up with everything which the unlimited is doing. So, he reveals himself as much as he wants for each and one of us. But, he's unlimited.
Yeah, what comes up for me is that there's this aspect that Krishna is, when he acts, he doesn't act in let's say, one dimension. Mm-hmm. There's always so many different layers to one particular activity. Like when he lifts Govardhan Hill, everybody in every rasa felt in a particular way and had a particular reciprocation with Krishna at the same time. So there's all of these different layers, and even when you read about his pastimes, there's only so much that can be said in a book. So there's in that sense. Although at the same time, whenever we read it, we can find new things. So it's always ever fresh as well.
Mm-hmm.
But still, then there's still, when we read the same pastime narrated by another of our acharyas, then there's mm-hmm. always new things, new aspects that are highlighted. So mm-hmm. it always goes deeper and further and relates to other devotees. Like, there's millions of cows and millions of cowherd boys, and none of them feels excluded. So there's so much going on that we can't be aware of at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. We should have started from this question, just had a discussion.
I was also thinking that of the pastime where, you know, Lord Brahma of our universe thinks he's the only Brahma,
mm-hmm.
and then there are so many million other ones of all the other universes with all the different number of heads. So it's not our universe where Krishna's pastimes are only taking place. His pastimes are taking place unlimitedly in unlimited different universes. Our little cosmic manifestation here is compared to a mustard seed in a bag of mustard seeds. And we're in some tiny part of creation. And Krishna's pastimes here are being displayed so that we could actually, you know, grasp a little bit of it there. But in all of these other wondrous places, his pastimes are different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, same, and also different according to the different places. So, yeah, we could understand maybe something, some grammar, when we have some less reading, we can understand even these, as I'm sure you're saying. They're fantastic, they have so many different layers, and there's so much depth in them. And just these pastimes that we have, you know, have some kind of knowledge of, and the other ones that we don't have knowledge of, it's probably because we can't grasp, we can't, our limited selves can't grasp and understand and comprehend these type of pastimes.
Mm-hmm.
But they are unlimited, they do exist.
Yeah.
It's also why we need spiritual master. Spiritual master often is the transparent by media. So it's through the spiritual master that we can actually see, really see and understand the pastimes in the pure body.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sometimes explained like a pure body is like a pair of glasses that you put on and you can actually see. So that is why we need a pure body to really get an understanding.
I certainly can't understand how I could be one and millions of cows and not feel neglected by Krishna. Can we finish it?
Thank you very much for your patience.